You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello, and time now for this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Let's start off in our solar system. Jupiter, the largest planet in the solar system, has, almost 70 moons, and now we know it's got even more.
Yeah, that's right. Nearly 80 moons in total, including some quite interesting new additions. So it might seem quite strange that we're constantly finding new moons for Jupiter. But these new moons are very small, and they're also quite far away from the planet itself. Mm. So they're actually very difficult to find, these type of things. So it really does take, it's really a labour of love to find things like this.
The moons that we often think of with Jupiter are called the Galilean moons, the four largest moons of Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede and Callisto, discovered by Galileo in 1610. And they're hundreds or thousands of kilometres across.
Yeah, they're really big. And they're very close to the planet. Yeah. And you can see them moving in a matter of hours. Yeah. You can see them changing position.
Whereas the new moons that have been discovered, and many of the other plethora of moons around Jupiter, are just a kilometre or so across. They're really very small. Just basically lumps of rock.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And captured asteroids, that's basically what they are.
Now, most of them orbit further out than the main moon system of Jupiter, and they go backwards.
Yeah,
Jupiter, which is unusual,
bizarre. Yeah, but if they are captured asteroids, then it could be, or they could be from a larger asteroid that had some impact, and that impact caused the retrograde motion.
So this is where we talk about captured asteroid, an asteroid that just got too close to Jupiter and got trapped orbiting Jupiter instead of going on around the sun.
That's right, because there is quite a lot of asteroids close-ish to Jupiter. The asteroid, the main asteroid belt, is between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. So it's the type of thing where Jupiter's pull and the sun's pull moves, this great interplay moves asteroids out of their comfort zone and in towards the sun or out towards the depths of space.
Well, one of the moons is slightly unusual. It orbits at the same distance from Jupiter as these retrograde moons. But it's not going retrograde, it's going the right way around Jupiter.
Yeah, which is bizarre because it's really a fish going against the flow.
You'd expect it to crash into the other moons at some point eventually. Space is big.
Yeah.
But how stable it is, who knows? It might crash in one day or get ejected from the system or something.
Yeah, that's right.
The discovery was made by people looking much further away than Jupiter. They were looking out to the depths of the outer solar system, looking for objects out beyond Pluto. In fact, something called Planet Nine.
Yeah, Planet Nine being something that... I remember when people were talking about Planet 10,
yeah.
And that seems like a flight of fancy now. When the Planet 9 was something that captured people's interest, I guess, a year or 2 years ago?
A couple of years ago.
Led by Mike Brown, I think, who whose Twitter handle, I think, is Pluto Killer, is one of the people who discovered very large objects in the solar system that really put into doubt whether Pluto should be considered a planet or one of these other dwarf planets.
And so after discovering that Pluto shouldn't be a planet, then a few years later, recently, a couple of years ago, predicted with other people that there could be a large planet out there, maybe bigger than Mars, smaller than Saturn, say, orbiting out beyond Pluto and Neptune, looping very far out, that is disturbing the orbits of other large objects out there and to the patterns that are observed, which otherwise are hard to explain.
Yeah, that's right. But it is very, very difficult to do because you're looking at very small things that are very faint, very far away, and you're trying to do high precision measurements of their position to see if there's anything wrong with their position. So you're looking for something. You're not looking for the object itself. You're looking for the disturbance it's causing in other things that are very faint, very far away, and very small.
And so finding the object itself, which might be tens of thousands of times further away from the sun than the Earth is, so incredibly far away, incredibly faint, and possibly in a very crowded part of the sky. But while looking for that, they happened to be looking close to where Jupiter was in the sky and found some moons tracking across the field of view. So a nice serendipitous discovery.
Yeah, it just goes to show that there are many other moons out there that will probably be found.
Now, talking about things that have never been seen directly, we've got an observatory, or first observation of a new planet going around another star. So planets form in disks of material around stars, and we've seen this before. We've seen disks of material around stars with patterns in.
Yeah, that's right. And we've seen them by a variety of different means. But mostly you're looking for the object itself. You're looking to take a picture. It's very difficult to take a picture of an exoplanet because you've got a faint thing next to a bright thing. But if you've got a planet forming, you've normally got the star is enclosed in a shell, a cocoon of the material that it's going to form its solar system out of. So the star is a bit dimmer normally. And if you're looking in, and you don't then normally look in invisible in the type of light that we see with our eyes. And so it's a lot easier to find these little things that are growing out of this cocoon or this shell around a star.
And that cocoon is normally spread out into a disk, and that dusty, gassy disk has the materials that the planets form from. And as they're forming, they carve out these gaps in the disk, a bit like we see gaps in Saturn's rings from a similar kind of process. But you get gaps in them, you get these dark lines, and we've seen lots of that before, but never before seen direct evidence of them there being a planet within that gap.
Yeah, that's right.
And so this is the first time we've seen that. It's a relatively local star, so it's a bit closer to us, and it's a dim star. It's a dwarf star. So
yeah, and that makes it easier to see because the star itself isn't outshining the planet and the disk and everything that we're trying to look at.
Now, the star goes by the catchy name of PDS-70, and so the planet is called PDS-70b. So maybe it'll get renamed at some point. It's been seen orbiting in this gap by the Very Large Telescope down in Chile, and hopefully is the first of many. The planet's relatively large. It's a few times larger than Jupiter, like a few times the mass of Jupiter, and it's very close to its star, so its surface is somewhere 1,000 degrees C, so not a very nice place.
And it's interesting that the way that you detect planets normally means that you do find big planets, ones that are physically large, or you find ones that are massive because of the two different ways that the two main ways that you discover planets. This is a planet, a brand new planet, and it's interesting that it is so close to the star and it is a massive planet.
Mm-hmm. Of course, those massive planets might end up with moons. Just as Jupiter's got 79 moons now, then maybe this planet's got a number of moons forming. So if the planet itself is a gas giant, then perhaps, who knows, some of the moons might be a bit more habitable.
And also, planets, even though it's quite close to the star, planets could migrate. They could move in their own solar system as time goes on, because this is a brand new solar system. And it could, in fact, Jupiter could have started life closer to our sun, and the arrangement of the planets with time, with many billions of years, have shifted.
From discoveries of new objects to inaugurations of new telescopes. We have a telescope in South Africa called Meerkat, but it's a radio telescope, and it's a very large radio telescope.
It's a radio telescope, but it's also a pathfinder, a technology demonstrator for this even larger telescope called the Square Kilometer Array. And so the reason for it being such an important step is that this is going to form a major part of this larger telescope, which is going to be spread across southern Africa and Australia.
And in Australia, they have something called the Murchison Wide Field Array, which is a radio telescope there. Now they have Meerkat in South Africa. It's great to see these coming to fruition to show that the Square Kilometre Array is getting closer.
Yeah, it's an enormous undertaking. And there's some fantastic benefits to the local community about this, because the amount of data that will come off these telescopes, they can be operated as a single telescope or a many telescope network, so they can be independent or working together. The amount of data is going to be colossal. In fact, there aren't computers around today that could process this data fast enough for us to get it off the telescope and process it without having to store, without taking the entire internet to store it. So they're allowing for technology to increase at the same rate that it's been increasing for the last 20 years, which might work, might not. It's a little bit of a gamble there. But this the Meerkat took an extremely high precision view of the very center of the Milky Way. So it's looking at something that we've known a lot about for a long, long time, but looking at it in a very different and very detailed way, using looking at radio light. And it looks, frankly, quite spectacular. Looks totally different to the type of view of the Milky Way that you're used to as well, because you're not looking invisible, you're looking in radio.
It's a much higher resolution view than we've seen with any other radio telescope in the past, I believe. So it shows filaments, little lines, it shows bubbles of gas being blown by exploding stars, largely, I imagine. A huge amount of detail in there. The development of the full thing is going to take a large amount of infrastructure as well. So there's going to be power stations and roads need to be built in Southern Africa. So that's where the local development becomes very important.
And high-speed internet as well. That's something which is... has been phenomenal, and Africa for a long time, sub-Saharan Africa, had relied on mobile internet and not broadband cable fiber-fed internet, and now in this area that they couldn't survive, that you wouldn't be able to get the data to anywhere useful. So that's meant that certainly through South Africa there's a lot more reliable internet available.
So we're looking forward to the development of future generations of this leading up to the square kilometre array. Now, normally we speak in this programme about astrophysics, astronomy. That's largely things we see with light, electromagnetic radiation in all its forms, so optical light that we see with our eyes, or radio waves, or infrared light. We have in recent years talked about gravitational waves, of course, and their detection. But there's another type of detection we can make in astronomy, and that's detecting particles coming from very extreme events out in space. One of these particular particles is called a neutrino, notoriously hard to detect and hard to collect with telescopes, but we are able to do that. And neutrinos have been detected by telescopes all over the world. They're pretty unusual detectors. We'll hear more about those shortly. I think the second time we've seen neutrinos from an astronomical event and be able to tie particularly these particles picked up in coincidence with something going bang in the night a long way away. Now, to find out more about neutrinos, this is particle physics, and we're normally an astronomy programme. So to find out more about the particle physics, I thought I'd speak to Dr. Ben Still, who's an honorary research fellow at Queen Mary University London and author of Particle Physics Brick by Brick, which is a guide to the history of the universe using Lego, which is all good fun. I began by asking Ben to describe what a neutrino is.
Well, neutrinos are part of the smallest subset of nature's building blocks. So if you split everything around you up into the smallest constituents, you end up with certain particles called quarks, which make up protons and neutrons. You end up with electrons, which I hope you're familiar with, that kind of give us the chemistry of atoms. And then you get these neutrino particles, which haven't really been understood for a very long time. They were in fact only first actually predicted to exist in 1930, but now over the past few decades we've really got a handle on what these bizarre particles are and what role they play in nature.
So we have the protons, neutrons and electrons that make up atoms that we're used to seeing, so tables, desks, computers, microphones, headphones, all made of atoms and so on. And then we've got these other things as well. Now, you said they were a very recent prediction back in the 1930s. In astronomy, we're used to finding things by seeing something unusual, by seeing an event and going, oh, we've seen something we've not seen. We've observed something we've not predicted before, and then going to figure out what it is. In particle physics with neutrinos, was it the other way around then? Were these predicted back in the 1930s and then observed much later?
In fact, they were predicted because there was a small difference in something called beta radioactive decay. So beta decay is when a nucleus transforms into another through a radioactive decay and spits out an electron in the process. And through measuring the energies of these electrons, it was thought that all of the electrons would come off with the same energy for the same given decay. because simply the same energy would be lost each time. But what was seen is the electrons came off with a whole host of different energies. And the only way to explain this, in Enrico Fermi's idea, who was a famous Italian physicist at the time, was the fact that there was something else being emitted alongside the electron, something that wasn't being seen, that was taking away a share of the energy of different amounts each time. And so, in fact, the neutrino was predicted to explain something that couldn't otherwise be explained. So, in a way, the prediction came out of something that was unexpected in terms of radioactivity. But then it took 26 years before the neutrino was actually seen. And that is because the neutrino is a notoriously tough customer to actually detect.
So it's this neutrino is hard to find. They, as you say, they're notoriously difficult to detect. How do we go about detecting them?
Well, the problem with the neutrino is it doesn't have an electric charge. Most of the ways in which we see particles in our universe through particle detectors and other means involves the electromagnetic force. It involves the fact that these particles have an electric charge, and that electric charge is going to influence other particles around it, also with electric charge. The neutrino has zero electric charge, and so it can't be seen through the traditional methods. In fact, the neutrino only interacts via something called the weak nuclear force. And this weak nuclear force has a very short range of ability to influence things. The electromagnetic force and electric charge can be felt infinitely out into space. That's why light can arrive to us from billions of years, in the past, from very distant stars, because light and the electromagnetic force is infinite in range. But the weak nuclear force is limited to the size of the nucleus of an atom. And the nucleus of an atom in size is just 0.0001% of the entire atom itself. And when you limit it to actually that range of interaction, it means that the neutrino sees the atom as 99.999% empty space, no matter what atom it comes into contact with. And so it's not really that the neutrino is ghostly, it's just that it doesn't notice the matter around us, because to it, it's mostly empty space.
And so to actually have this neutrino interact with matter and therefore be able to detect it, we've got to get really lucky. It's got to happen to get close enough to one of these nuclei in our detector to find them. And that means you need a lot of nuclei and a lot of neutrinos to do this. So it's a game of probabilities, essentially. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's like trying to catch a piece of dust with a very fine webbed net. Really, it's that kind of game. And of course, you're not going to catch much dust with a very fine web net, because most of the dust slips through the holes. And in our analogy, the net is those nuclei, the very center of the atom with which the neutrino will interact, and the dust is the neutrino. And the thing is, the only way to increase that is either increase the amount of dust that you're wafting through your net by increasing the flux of neutrinos, which is done in experiments here on Earth through man-made neutrino beams, and or you can increase the size of your net by increasing the number of atoms and therefore nuclei that you've got able to actually interact with the neutrino.
So you need a lot of nuclei or a very big detector, and the detectors for neutrinos are extreme, I think it's probably fair to say, in their properties. I'm used to a telescope, you know, a few meters across, maybe. Neutrino detectors work in a very different way. Can you describe a few of the neutrino detectors for us?
Absolutely. So I think probably one of the most iconic ones is the Super Kamiokande detector, which is based in the west of Japan. It sat underneath a mountain, underneath about a kilometer of rock. And it's 33 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth, or 50,000 tons of water, waiting to see a neutrino interaction. And as we've said, it's about a statistic. So you need as much stuff possible to actually try and catch a single neutrino interaction. Even then, this massive detector only sees a handful of neutrinos each day from the hundreds and hundreds of billions that actually pass through it. And so even then, it's a waiting game. Probably the biggest detector now on Earth is the Ice Cube detector, which is the one we're going to talk about in a minute, which has detected this high energy neutrino. The Ice Cube detector instruments a cubic kilometer of ice. This cubic kilometer of ice is about 1.4 kilometers underneath the surface. And it's instrumented with very sensitive photodetectors. And it's sat there looking for bursts of light that are coming from particles created by neutrinos. I can't really imagine this detector. A cubic kilometer is just such a phenomenal size that it makes it probably the biggest net that we've got certainly to date to be able to catch neutrinos.
And so the detector itself, although it's got all these photo detectors down under the ice along the connected together with cables and so on, I guess up to the surface, the detector itself is kind of the big cubic kilometer of ice itself. That's the key to this detector working, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So I mean, the ice itself is our net that we're using to try and catch the neutrino, and then we just see the aftermath of a neutrino interacting with one of the nuclei in the vastness of all that ice.
Okay, so and even so, you don't detect very many neutrinos. How many neutrinos have we found? You say, was it a handful per day was detected?
So in Supercamacan, it's a handful per day, yes. The Ice Cube detector detects a vast amount more simply because it's instrumenting a hell of a lot more ice, a hell of a lot more massive stuff. And so you've got many more nuclei to interact with.
Do these neutrinos all come from space? Is that the thinking?
The majority of the neutrinos that is seen by IceCube actually come from the atmosphere. So it comes from cosmic ray interaction. Now, cosmic rays are protons, as you find in the nucleus of an atom, positively charged particles that come from some unknown sources in the universe. They hit the Earth fairly evenly. In all directions, they hit the upper atmosphere, and the energy they have is converted into the mass of new particles using Einstein's most famous equation, E=mc². And these new particles rain down upon us all the time. And as they do, they decay and they change through radioactive decays as well into new particles. And part of this particle shower is a number of different neutrinos. And these neutrinos then will pass through the Earth. And IceCube is actually looking down towards the center of the Earth. It's interested in doing that because it's looking at filtering out all of the other particles that are coming through those cosmic ray showers. It doesn't want to see those. So the electrons, the heavier versions of it, the muons, it doesn't want to see any of that. So it uses the entire Earth like a filter. And it filters out all of those extra particles. And the only things, because of their ghostly nature, that make it all the way through the Earth from the atmosphere on the other side is the neutrino. And then if there is an interaction within the ice and those particles are spraying upwards into the Ice Cube detector, then you can be fairly sure that it's a neutrino that's instigated that upward coming shower of particles in that event.
So that's astonishing. So not just is this big cubic kilometer of ice part of the detector, but it also depends on the fact that there's a 13,000 kilometer diameter ball of rock beneath it as well. So I guess that probably does make it the largest detector we have. That's amazing. All right. So we think most of these neutrinos come from the atmosphere. It'll be the atmosphere on the other side of the Earth. But a few of them must come from further afield. What kind of astrophysical events do we think create neutrinos that IceCube might be able to detect?
Well, if we're talking about multi-messenger astronomy with neutrinos, this isn't actually the first astronomical object that we've seen in neutrinos. The first astronomical object we actually observed in neutrinos, of course, is the Sun. And the Kamiokande predecessor to Supercamiokande and Supercamiokande itself have both built up quite clear pictures of the Sun. Now, the Sun is obviously not the most interesting in terms of observation because we can obviously see it very clearly in our night sky, and we've got quite a good idea of how processes in the Sun actually work. But the neutrinos come from any star through the fusion process, and so any star will produce vast amounts of neutrinos. The Sun is the only star close enough for us to actually observe it in the neutrino observatory. The neutrinos spread out from the star, and they become so dilute that because they're dilute and ghostly in nature, we don't actually see neutrinos from other stars directly. Other sources, so for instance, the second observation of an astronomical object through neutrinos was actually in 1987, and it was from a supernova explosion. So the first supernova of the year in January of 1987 exploded in the night sky, and it was seen as an influx of neutrinos over a very short period of time. What I find quite astonishing is that when astrophysicists were trying to simulate supernova explosions by the outside of the star bouncing off of a solid core as the star kind of implodes on itself, they found that they couldn't propagate that shockwave, the shockwave that caused the explosion. And in fact, when they added a vast number of neutrinos coming out from this supernova, the shock was reignited and the explosion could occur in their simulations. What we think today is over 99% of the energy of a supernova is actually released in the form of neutrinos. So while a supernova explosion death of a star might outshine its host galaxy for that brief period of time, that's less than 0.5% of the entire energy output of the supernova explosion. 99% is released in neutrinos. And so you can imagine from a supernova explosion, we have a vast number of neutrinos coming outwards into the universe. And in 1987, for the first time, it was seen in a number of different neutrino detectors all around the globe. And this, just to give you an idea of, so the detectors at the time, the Kamiokande detector, which is the predecessor to Super Kamiokande, would see on average about one neutrino per day, either coming from the sun or from these atmospheric neutrinos we've talked about. In a period of 10 seconds, the Kamiokande detector detected 12 neutrinos. That just tells you the phenomenal increase in the number of neutrinos that they get. Just dividing, just kind of looking at the ratio of 12 seconds to the number of seconds in a day tells you the ratio of the increase in intensity of these neutrino events that were coming, and they were coming from this supernova. And this was the first multi-messenger astronomy really to be done in neutrinos, because the afterglow, the remnant of the supernova, was seen quite clearly with telescopes around the world. And it was the first example of neutrinos being linked to an astrophysical event. So supernova deaths of stars emit huge amounts of neutrinos as well. And in fact, it's the neutrino detectors on Earth now have a supernova notification network. If they get a burst of neutrino events similar to the one seen in 1987A, obviously we would now, with much larger detectors, see a vast increase in the number of neutrinos. But they are all connected together, these neutrino observatories around the world, with a supernova early delay system. And that is also linked then to optical telescopes to hopefully see a new supernova in our galaxy. But we expect these kind of supernova to exist maybe once in a century, or at maximum once in 30 years. So fingers crossed, we might actually see one in our lifetime.
So unlikely, but possibly going to happen. The event that took place early this month, or the announcement that took place early this month, was about an event from a little while ago. What was what happened recently to hit the news with this ice cube detection?
Over the numerous astrophysical sources of neutrinos, one that was lower down on the list was an object called a blazar. Now, obviously, I'm a particle physicist, so do forgive me for my explanation of a blazar. But as I understand it, a blazar is a black hole in the center of a galaxy, a supermassive black hole. And there's matter falling into this black hole. And as the matter falls in, it accelerates to vast, vast speeds, much like you get in a particle accelerator. And as it accelerates inwards, it emits a lot of electromagnetic radiation. And this electromagnetic radiation, which also gives birth to new particles and jets of energy, is kind of let out along the poles, the north and south pole of this black hole, so kind of right angles to the way the black hole is spinning. And if one of those north or south poles is pointing directly at the Earth, then the Earth gets a huge amount of energy directed towards it from this blazar. And it's known that this involves charged particles because of the electromagnetic radiation that is seen from these particular objects. It's been seen in gamma rays and X-rays and right across the electromagnetic spectrum. What was not known was the fact that these particular entities might emit neutrinos. Thinking about it in hindsight, with all the charged particles and especially the protons, which are actually used to create neutrino beams on Earth, it makes sense that these particle interactions that are going on in these jets coming out of the blazar would involve at some point neutrinos. And that is what was seen by the IceCube detector.
So we saw neutrinos from this this blazar event, which we know about because we've seen it in light as well. What do we learn from combining neutrino observations with electromagnetic, with light observations? Because you mentioned supernovae. Well, we've seen lots of supernovae, and then we expected there to be these neutrinos from them. What are we like to learn in the future from future detections of this kind?
Measuring the neutrinos gives us a unique insight. Any electromagnetic radiation will be affected by intergalactic magnetic fields. It may be absorbed and re-emitted by interstellar gas. And there's lots of reasons that light can't make it easily between the object that's creating it and our telescopes here or in orbit around Earth. The beauty of the neutrino is, because it's so ghostly and because it doesn't interact much with all of the other interstellar gas or magnetic fields, it flies straight and true. It's not affected by magnetic fields. It's not going to be absorbed and re-emitted. And we're not really going to see that much of a decrease in the amount of neutrinos that are coming towards us. And so the neutrino flying straight and true gives us a direct kind of gateway to the heart of the processes that are happening. And so from this, we will probably be able to gain a more accurate understanding of exactly the particle interactions that are going on within these jets, and therefore maybe the energy and the process in which these jets are produced in black holes. Of course, with just one single neutrino, it's very difficult to actually glean any information apart from the fact that it can be linked to this blazar. We're going to now need to build up a number of different observations with neutrinos. The awkwardness of them is that they are so ghostly that we see them so rarely. But hopefully now, with the proof of principle, we'll start to see more neutrino events coming through. In fact, when IceCube looked back in the historical record, they did notice an excess of neutrinos coming from the exact same spot in the sky in September of 2014 and March of 2015. This was before the high energy event online kind of alarm system was actually put in place, which is what alerted the other satellites to this event. But looking back, they found that there was an excess of neutrino events in that region of the sky, which they hadn't originally seen before. And again, these neutrinos may well have come from that blazar. And so now that we're actually identifying these particular sources, we'll be able to build up a higher statistics of events. And from the distribution of energies in neutrinos, we'll be able to glean an idea of the processes and the particle interactions going on in the actual the blazar.
You've said these are high energy neutrinos from astronomical sources. What kind of energy are we talking about here? How high energy is high energy?
Well, in terms of the neutrinos that IceCube Observatory is seeing, this particular neutrino isn't massively high in energy. So, but it is still the neutrino that interacted within the ice was about over 40 times the energy of a proton at the Large Hadron Collider. So it's an energy which we measure in terms of things called electron volts, and it's an energy of around 300 tera electron volts. Tera means 10 to the 12, so that's a million. Which is actually, as I said, for an IceCube neutrino, quite low, because IceCube neutrinos have been seen in terms of peta electron volts. Sorry, I'll say that again. So ice cube neutrinos have actually been seen in energies up to peta electron volts, which is 10 to the 15 or 1,000 million million electron volts, which is a thousand times greater than the protons at the Large Hadron Collider.
So these are energies that we simply can't recreate ourselves. We have to use, you know, nature's own particle accelerators, these astronomical events, to create these things. We can't do that on Earth at all.
Absolutely not. We would need to recreate the conditions around a supermassive black hole, which simply is not available to us on Earth. We could build a particle accelerator which has the radius of the Earth goes right around the equator, and we still wouldn't come anywhere close to being able to reproduce these energies. And so using astrophysical sources like this is a very good way of probing high energy physics. The downside is, of course, that we don't get to choose where and when and how often we get these particles impinging on the Earth. And so it gets a little bit difficult to be able to run these experiments if you don't have control over the source. It also makes it difficult because, of course, we need to understand the astrophysical source from which these particles are coming. So there's a little bit of a catch-22 in some cases, because we need an understanding of the astrophysical source to predict what the particles will be and what energies they will come with. But also, in some cases, we're using the particles to understand the astrophysical source and therefore the processes that are producing the particles in the first place. And so we're gradually teasing out the difference between using particles to understand and using electromagnetic radiation to understand some of these astrophysical sources. And that's why multi-messenger astronomy is so important, because just one alone will only give us one side of the coin. We really need both working in unison to be able to truly understand everything about the universe.
So how do we know that this neutrino came from something astronomical and not something more mundane, like an interaction in the Earth's atmosphere?
Well, on the outset, really, it was kind of a coin toss as to whether this came from an astrophysical source or whether this neutrino was just a high-energy atmospheric neutrino. The probability was around about 56.5% that it came from a source outside of our own galaxy. And so it was essential then that the information was relayed to a number of different telescopes and observatories around the world, and space-borne telescopes as well, to try and see if there was anything in that region of sky that agreed within errors to the neutrino that was seen. And it was the Fermi Fermi Large Area Telescope that was the first to come to the rescue, so to speak, and say that they saw, 3 days later, quite a significant increase in the emission of gamma rays, very high energy electromagnetic rays, coming from the same area of space. And they located it right directly to this blazar. This blazar has a very natty name, TXS 0506 plus 56. And they agreed quite well within error as to the location of this particular source. And then as days went by, there was the MAGIC telescope in Spain, which actually saw higher energy gamma rays being emitted from exactly the same source. And then as it went through the weeks, we were seeing that there was a high luminosity of visible light. There was a huge amount of radio waves being emitted. And right across the electromagnetic spectrum, there was an increase in the amount of energy being released from this blazar that coincided with the neutrino being released. And so that kind of coincidence went from being a coin toss to being a 0.003% probability of it not being the same source.
A lot of information, a lot of work gone into this one event, which it gives us a nice example of multi-messenger astronomy. One question at the end then, if people want to find out more about neutrinos and particle physics and so on, any suggestions for where they could find out more?
To find out more about IceCube, the University of Wisconsin-Madison has a fantastic public outreach website. You can find out everything about the detector. You can find out a whole host of stats that we haven't talked about here. It's quite phenomenal, in fact, the technological feats that they've overcome. I would also suggest looking on Particle Adventure. It's a great site hosted by Fermilab. It's a great way to kind of get into particle physics if you've never really kind of delved into that before. I'm not going to be crass and promote my book, but that is another option. I also used to write a neutrino blog. I haven't updated it recently, but it's got a lot of fundamental neutrino physics on there as well, if you wanted to know a little bit more specifically about neutrinos.
Great. Well, there'll be links to those on the website for this podcast. So that's pythagastro.uk. You can find this episode and see some of the links there. For now, Ben Still, thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, having detections of neutrinos from astronomical sources, Edward, is certainly fascinating to do. And again, it's a step on the way to learning a lot more about these things.
Yeah, and they're such slippery customers as well. Yeah. They interact so weakly with matter, with just everything, that they're so hard to actually detect. And the way that you detect them is that you wait for them to hit something and cause a reaction in that thing, and then. And then you pick up the tiny, tiny glow of light from it. The ice cube detector in Antarctica is quite an amazing bit of engineering as well. You know, you drill down 10 times deeper than the Eiffel Tower, and you have basically strings with little balls on them that are waiting for these tiny glows from where a neutrino hits the ice around it.
So we're not in all of these things, we're not detecting the neutrino itself, we're detecting the flash of light from the neutrino hitting this enormous block, this cubic kilometer of ice down at Antarctica. And other detectors work in similar ways with huge vats of water and so on. I didn't realize until chatting to Ben that they look downwards, they look through the Earth, and that's to block out all the other particles that might come from space. They leave just the neutrinos. The neutrinos will happily pass straight through the Earth. I remember hearing you need about a light year of lead to stop a neutrino. So
wow.
10,000 kilometers or so of rock doesn't bother them at all.
Yeah, but if you have enough of them, there'll be just one that will, you know, interact, and that's what you're waiting for.
So the ice cube detector is not just a cubic kilometer of ice. It relies on the fact that there's over 10,000 kilometers of rock beneath it as well to filter out all the other particles. So I think that probably makes it the largest detection system on the way. Well, is the planet? So on the planet.
Yeah. Yes.
So hopefully we'll hear more about this in coming years as neutrino telescopes get more, neutrino detectors get more powerful, and we get better at doing this very time-sensitive, this transient astronomy, as it's called. It's something that you focus on at Lascombes Observatory.
Yeah, that's right. Transient astronomy and time domain astronomy, things that are changing, that's what we do because we have a network of telescopes that can respond very rapidly to things like that. And really that's now where astronomy is going. We are looking for things that change with all these surveys, like started with Pan-STARRS and then moving to the LSST and all these other survey telescopes that are coming. They rely on there being follow-up partners like Lascombes.
And the holy grail, this is often called multi-messenger astronomy, because it's using light, it's using neutrinos, in this case, but also gravitational waves, all very different ways of picking up information and tell us very different things about events. And I guess the next kind of holy grail in this is to find an event that emits gravitational waves and light and neutrinos.
Yes,
so
that's right.
Maybe one day we'll pick up something like that. So fingers crossed for that in the future. That's it for this month. We'll be back next month. Don't forget, you can go to pythagastro.uk to hear previous episodes and subscribe to the podcast. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.